Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello everyone, I am Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast, seeking to bring you the very best in Christian apologetics so you may be thoroughly equipped to go out there and do your work for the kingdom of God. And today, it's of course going to be no exception. A few months ago, Don Johnson of Don Johnson Evangelistic Ministries contacted me saying, "Hey, I've written a book, would you like to review it? It's called How to Talk to a Skeptic." Sure, send it my way. And indeed he did. I read the book. I reviewed it. I think probably the first review to go up on Amazon. And I liked it enough, so I said, "Hey, you need to come on my show." And now, who is Don Johnson? Don Johnson is a president of Don Johnson Evangelistic Ministries. That's a non-profit organization, and it has three main goals. Boldly and creatively proclaim the kingdom of God through various means of mass communication. Get people to think about big questions of life. Share with them God's answer to those questions. And train and equip believers to share and defend the gospel. In order to do this, Don preaches at churches, colleges, and other types of evangelistic outreach events around the world. He has a call-in talk show, so he's no stranger to a show like this one, and writes for web and print publication. Plus, his training seminars are offered at church and college campus ministries, and he enjoys hosting open-form events for seekers and skeptics. For his education, he's served in vocational ministry since 1993, including extensive experience as an inner-city youth worker and young adult pastor. He has a Bachelor of Arts in Theology, Missions, and Intercultural Studies from San Jose Christian College, a Master of Arts in Christian Apologetics from Biola University, and a Master of Arts in Theology from Franciscan University of Steubenville. Not only that, he's done graduate work in the Evangelism Program at Multnomah Seminary and the Philosophy of Religion Program at Talbot School of Theology. He enjoys hosting tours of the Holy Land and spending time with his wife and four children. And as I said, his latest book was just released by Bethany House, and it's How to Talk to a Skeptic, an easy-to-follow guide for natural conversations and effective apologetics. So here to help us learn how to talk to a skeptic is Don Johnson. Don, welcome to the Deeper Waters Podcast.
It's a great honor to be with you, Nick. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. Now, before we get into the meat of a show here, tell my audience a little bit about yourself. That's not in the bio. How did you get to be doing what you're doing?
You know, I never thought I would be doing this, Nick. I grew up in Canada, actually. I was a farm boy from Midwestern Canada, and my dad is still a church planting pastor. We had a very ministry-centered family. And frankly, growing up, I didn't think that I really wanted too much to do with that. And so I kind of did my own thing for a few years, and in my early 20s, through various ways, God called me into the ministry, in fact. And so I've always kind of been centered on evangelism and trying to reach people with the gospel. It always struck me as, what could be more important than this sort of thing. And so I moved to California in my early 20s. Back in the early 90s, in fact, I've been in California since the early 90s, started doing some inner city work and did some college pastoring. And over the years, I realized that I really loved talking with people about Jesus, but not only that, answering the questions that they had about Jesus. And people had a lot of questions. And so, especially with college ministry, college-age kids, I mean, they're really seeking, they're looking for big answers to those big questions of life. And so the realm of apologetics sort of drew me in. I didn't necessarily set out to be an apologist, but it drew me in as part of my evangelistic ministry. And so I started a call-in talk show. We got on the air out here in L.A., and that really increased my desire to learn apologetic stuff. So I went to Biola, learned about that, did some more graduate work. And as I continued in the ministry, I realized that there was more and more questions, not just from unbelievers, but from believers. You know, my fellow churchgoers were having a lot of issues. Hey, I've got, you know, my uncle came over for Thanksgiving and had a lot of difficult questions. And so I really have moved more recently into helping train believers to deal with their skeptical friends and family. So in a very brief nutshell, that's kind of my story of how I ended up with a book like this.
Now, tell us about the radio show also. What is the show? How long is it? Where can people find it? When does it air? That kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. The show is called The Don Johnson Show. We actually, I got on the air, just to give you a brief history of it, in the 90s up in Portland with a man named Bob Kreider, who has since gone to be with the Lord. But Bob was gracious enough to allow me to sit in with him on a local secular station, which has always been sort of my goal, is to reach people on a more secular network or station. And so we would take calls and talk to unbelievers, and that grew into, when I moved back to California around 2001, moved into doing my own show out here in L.A. called The Don Johnson Show on the local Salem networks. Now you can find it. We've actually found it more cost efficient to do like you do, Nick, just stream it online. Most of our listeners were joining us via podcast anyway, so now we stream it online at thedonjohnsonshow.com. We're on Friday mornings, most Friday mornings at 8:30 a.m. Pacific. So that's when my co-host Brandon and I can be here. But all of the archives, there's hundreds of shows actually available at thedonjohnsonshow.com or at donjohnsonministries.org, or you can just search The Don Johnson Show on iTunes. I think iTunes actually only does the latest 50 episodes, but that's probably enough. But if you want the full archives and all, they're categorized by topic. On my website, you can find them there. We do tend to focus on trying to bring non-believers onto the air to talk with them. So I will set up interviews with various, not just atheists, although there has been a lot of atheists on the show, but people from various worldviews. We had a guy call in from Hong Kong who wanted to defend Taoism. So that was interesting. We do a variety of stuff on the show.
Yeah, I think it's important that we each have our own niche in this area. Yours is wanting to have the atheists come on. Mine's wanting to get the scholars of Christianity to come on and present them to the public. And then someone like Justin Browley, say, of Unbelievable, goes in the middle and has the debates going on. And I think each of our shows does provide some sort of enrichment over all that. I mean, no one can do everything.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Nick. I mean, I think we're all gifted in different ways, and we all have different, passions and interests. And, yeah, I agree. I think your show and Justin's show and all the rest, I mean, there's some great podcasts out there. I think of Jim Wallace out here in Orange County does a great show, too, on training believers. So, yeah, between all of them, I think you can get pretty well educated and enriched by subscribing to them all if you've got time.
Yeah, which is something important that a lot of listeners don't need to. All listeners do need to know that some of you out there are thinking, you know, I just can't afford to go out there and get all these books and such. I'd love to. I don't know how I'm going to listen. How can I educate myself? If you go on iTunes with just the four shows we've talked about here, you've got more than enough to really build yourself up a good education. And, of course, by all means, I'm saying go out there, get the books when you can, read them. But don't think you have to do just that. That's why we have these kinds of shows to help people like you out.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Nick. I mean, I know myself. As much as I love to read, with all the family duties I have and all the other stuff I've got going on, I mean, I've got a stack of books way too high. I don't know when I'm going to get to them all. But I drive takes me about 20 to 30 minutes to get to my office every day. And, yeah, I've got lectures going, whether it's podcasts or there's all sorts of classes online that you can download. I know, you know, from various seminaries, even the great courses. I've recently been turned on to the great courses. There's some wonderful courses there that you can listen to. So, yeah, I agree. That's an excellent resource.
Yes, and you can also go to your library if I don't get resources like, say, Portable Professor or Modern Scholar of a Teaching Company and learn that way. And I'm with you. I have a stack high of books that I need to read, and yet still someone else will contact me sometime soon, I'm sure, and say, hey, I've got a book coming. Would you care to review it? Sure.
Yep.
I'll review it. I'm a glutton for punishment. Now, let's talk about these books. You've got this book, How to Talk to a Skeptic. First off, why did you write this book?
Yeah, you know, as I was sort of alluding to, I never set out, not only did I not set out to be in ministry, but I never set out to be an author. But as I was doing the radio show and talking to skeptics, a lot of the people who were listening to the show would be emailing me during the week, you know, between broadcasts, saying, you know, I liked how you handled that situation, but I've got this situation, you know, what can I do here? And so I would be spending a lot of my time corresponding with people who needed help in their own lives. That turned into a local conference, actually, was, I think, the main impetus for getting this book written. They invited me to do a seminar. And so I went and I did a How to Talk to an Atheist seminar, I think it was, and very well received. I mean, first of all, the room was packed. Just many more people showed up than they thought would, and everyone was very excited about it. They were all asking for the notes. And so I thought that, you know, we really maybe have hit on a need here within the church, that people do need some more equipping, as much as there is some great books out there. And I would try to encourage people, listen, here's, you know, Kochel's got this book, and William Lane Craig has it. There's great resources. But yet, I had over the years developed, not new information, but a model for helping the conversation not go downhill. And that was just from talking with people on my own. You know, I would think, all right, where did that conversation go bad? I mean, what made the guy angry, or how did it get to this dead end, or it seemed like we were talking past each other? And I would do a lot of self-analysis after each conversation and say, you know what exactly happened there? I would try to fix that for the next time. And over the years, I did actually develop a model where I basically used the same approach, not the same, you know, it's not a cookie-cutter thing, but the same basic approach to directing a conversation, and I found that it worked really well. And so I was trying to teach these principles to the people, and they were, you know, lapping it up. And so I thought, well, hey, maybe there is a book here. Put together a proposal and sent it out, and sure enough, Bethany House bought it. So, yeah, on one hand, it does seem like there's a lot of apologetics books. On the other, I think this one is a little bit different. It scratches a little bit different itch, if you will, meets a little bit different need. Something actually I think that I thought that you kindly brought out in your review is that, you know, hey, you know, do I really want to read another apologetics book? Well, yeah, this is a little bit different. So it's trying to meet that need where people need just a way to frame a conversation and direct it, not necessarily new information, but how to handle that conversation.
We had Greg Kochel on our show, I think it was March 23rd, definitely last year. We've been doing this podcast for nearly a year now, and we had him on to discuss his book, Tactics. And what I said about that book could apply to yours as well, that Tactics really isn't an apologetics book. If you're willing to get a book to sit down and I'd say this applies to yours also, sit down and say, find the big answers to questions, it's not fair. But if you want to know how you can work through the conversations and bring out the big answers, then this is where you go.
Yeah, that's right. I do think it is a similar style, absolutely, to Tactics, which is a great book, too. I mean, I recommend that one. I enjoy that book immensely.
Well, let's get started talking about the book. And the first chapter I'd like to get into, and we'll only be able to scratch the surface a little bit before we have to take our first break, but I consider it the most important chapter in the book. And that is the first chapter, No Selling Required. And I'll tell people, if you could only read one chapter of this book, read the first chapter, No Selling Required, because you hit on there a big problem with how we do evangelism today. What is the problem that we have?
Yeah, I think the big problem is that we don't approach the whole topic of religion properly, and the skeptic doesn't approach the whole topic of religion properly. And as such, when we go out to evangelize and talk to skeptics, because the whole subject isn't thought about correctly on sort of a foundational level, we really lead the people astray. I mean, we don't mean to, but we do. And here's what I mean. We generally approach, in our culture, we generally approach religion as something that is there to meet some need or desire in me, that it doesn't exist for any other reason beside that other than to provide me with something. And so I compare that to basically a consumer product of any kind. That's what I'm talking about, is that it's kind of like hairspray or a candy bar or whatever it is you go to the supermarket or go to Staples to buy, paper. It exists to meet some need in you. And maybe you don't have that need, and it's just a desire. Okay, fair enough. You know, you don't really need the TV, but you want it. That's why that TV exists, to meet that desire in you. Well, most people in our culture think of religion that way, as if it is just there to scratch some itch that I have. And when we approach religion that way, and unfortunately the church does approach it this way very often, we go to the person and we say, hey, you know, you've got this desire. Maybe you have a desire to, maybe you've got a stressful job. And so we can work with that. We can help you with your stress. Maybe your kids are running a little bit wild and they could use a little moral guidance, you know, a little structure in their lives. Hey, we can provide that for them. Maybe you just want a nice place to go hang out on a Saturday night. Well, hey, we've got a great band and very friendly people and a good coffee bar. Maybe you like good coffee. You know, we can provide that for you. Maybe you are lonely and you want some friendships. Hey, we've got not only the nice Saturday night service, but we've got small groups that you can be a part of. And really any need or desire that you have, the church presents itself as existing to meet those needs or desires. Now, that's not to say that we shouldn't be meeting people's needs, their real needs. I'm not saying that, so we can clarify that as we talk here, Nick. But the problem is that if you start the conversation that way, let's say that you go out and talk to your skeptical friend, and the first thing you say out of your mouth is, listen, look at what Jesus has done for me, or look what I found at this local church. If they're viewing it as a consumer product, what they can say is, and I'm sure we've all heard this in our lives, hey, I'm glad you found something that works for you, but I don't really think that I need that. Or maybe I do need that, but you know what? I found that somewhere else. I found it over at this religious gathering, or I found it down, you know, my psychologist took care of that, actually, or my doctor took care of that, prescribed something to me. Or, you know, some people pick and choose, and they meet their needs at a bunch of different places. I give several examples of this in the book, but you actually have people who are sending their kids to a Muslim mosque, for instance, for moral guidance. Well, they attend the Buddhist get-together on Tuesday mornings and do yoga to take care of their stress, while at the same time taking part in a little Jewish mysticism on the weekends. They pick and choose from a variety, and they don't see anything wrong with that. They're like, oh, you know, whatever, I just grab the needs wherever I can find them, you know, in the same way that we would go to Staples for paper and to, you know, the local grocery store for milk. They pick and choose and meet their needs that way. Well, what I suggest in the book is that this is the total wrong way to approach religion, that religion is not there as a consumer product. That's not why religions exist. But at a very foundational level, they are worldviews. All religions are worldviews. All worldviews are not necessarily religions, I wouldn't say, but I think all religions are worldviews. And what I mean by that is they answer the big questions of life, the big worldview questions. How did we get here? Why are we here? What's gone wrong with the world? Is there a solution to that problem? What is the solution? How should we then live? What happens when we die? All religions answer those questions. They tell you about the nature of reality. And as such, they are not like consumer products. they are much more like roadmaps. They portend to describe reality to us, the place where we live. They tell us about it. And if you go and pick a roadmap, well, it doesn't matter really if it works for you, right? What actually matters is if it's true. And so the big question when it comes to religions is it true? Is this religion true? If it's not true, it doesn't matter what it does for me. I shouldn't take part in this religion. I don't think I give this example in the book, but one I talk about in seminars is the example of Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise, big Scientologist. And he became a Scientologist because they helped him with his dyslexia. And, you know, that was great. I mean, he got help with his dyslexia, so he became a Scientologist. Well, Scientology teaches that we were deposited here by the intergalactic warrior Xenu millions of years ago in a volcano. And I mean, a nonsensical theology. But that's what they teach. That's their worldview. Well, it's false. So it doesn't matter what Scientology ultimately does for us. We can't become Scientologists if it's false, right? And they don't teach you that until you've spent thousands of dollars and gone several levels in, and then the theology comes out. Well, as Christians, we can't take that same approach necessarily. Of course, we should be out there helping people with their dyslexia. But we must say that the reason to become a Christian is because we have the accurate answers about the big questions of life. That's ultimately the foundational reason to become a Christian, I think. So it's really an issue of truth. And if we frame our discussions that way, it avoids a lot of the problems such as, oh, well, I'm glad you found something that works for you, right? The conversation should be about truth, I think.
Yeah, that's a whole lot, and I'm going to be responding to it. But before I respond to it, I'm going to take a break here. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Don Johnson of Don Johnson Evangelistic Ministries and Don Johnson Radio Show. We'll be back after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
And we're back with Don Johnson to talk about his book, How to Talk to a Skeptic. And if you want to call in and ask a question, the number is 714-242-5180. Now, on what I was thinking about with what you were saying is that too many times in our evangelism, we do go straight for the practical side. Then we go for the truth side. I had a quote going from my mind of C.S. Lewis saying, I never chose Christianity to make me happy. I knew a bottle of port would do that just fine. So that, in fact, if you're up for choosing a religion that makes you comfortable, I don't recommend Christianity. And if we're going out there... Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Nick. Sorry, that's a great quote. I just wanted to affirm. Yeah. I love that quote.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going out there and saying, hey, choose Jesus, he will bring you so much joy and happiness in your life, most people are going to say, yeah, I can go out and spend the night with my girlfriend and get fat just fine, thank you. Or I can go to the local bar about work, or I can go to a big sporting event. I mean, it could be something perfectly more, but I could say, I got something that brings me a lot of joy in my life, thanks.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There's a lot of things that meet those felt needs in the culture, and when we approach, I mean, it's tough because we do want to share all the good things that Jesus has done for us, right? But that at a foundational level down the road, let's say they do come to our church and enjoy it, but then something goes wrong. Maybe they have a conflict with somebody in the church, or, you know, maybe the band gets worse or the preaching gets worse or something, and it's just not as enjoyable as it once was, and it's not really meeting, you know, scratching that itch like it once was. And, well, then they're off down the street, right? Or maybe there are, who knows, maybe they stop going to church altogether. That shopping, you know, that church shopping sort of mentality, we really feed into that, don't we, when we try to make it all about what we can do for you. When we do sell church, sell Jesus in that way, we set ourselves up for a bunch of consumers in the pews, and then we wonder why, you know, they're so antsy. You know, they're so quick to say, well, this should be better, this should be better. Well, it's because they're, you know, the way we brought them in was to make them happy, right? To make them, yeah, you're right. I mean, yeah. Nick, Christianity doesn't always feel good, does it?
Yeah, and we've got so many seminars going on at churches, and each of these seminars in themselves can individually be a great thing. We can have seminars on how to manage your finances, or how to improve your marriage, or raising your children right, or getting over a divorce, or dealing with depression. And many of these, no doubt, they're great, they're helpful, we need to be doing them. But so rarely will you find the church having a seminar on, hey, here's how we're going to show you the Bible is reliable. Here's how we're going to show you that Jesus really did rise from the dead. Here's how we're going to show you how to answer all those people you meet on the internet.
Yeah, you're right. And that, if we did have those seminars, it would show that we care about truth, right? And you and I know it's tough sometimes to get people to think about apologetic issues and to think about questions of questions of truth or falsity. And, you know, it's because they do, I think, largely have that consumerist mindset towards church. And, you know, I think you're right that there's a balance there. It's not that we don't want to be doing all those things. It's that they have to be driven out of our conviction that we do have the truth about reality. And, I mean, not only does that lead us, I think, to offer those other things, to meet those other needs. But it also gives the people who are doing that, you know, the workers, a much stronger foundation for going out and doing those things. I mean, I think of people often, I mean, people even go out and serve because they want to meet some sort of need in themselves. You know, they go out and do a missions trip to Mexico or whatever. I mean, these are great things. I love those. We all need to be doing those. But a lot of times, I mean, I've been on so many of these kind of things. A lot of times the people are there not to actually serve, but to feel better about themselves and this kind of thing. And so then things don't go right. And, well, I just didn't have a very good trip and all the rest of it. And, well, again, we're not serving to meet a need in you, as good as this is going to be for you. We do it because we love Jesus and we're grounded in this truth about what he has done and continues to do in our lives. And therefore we go and serve. And I just think, you know, this was revolutionary in my ministry because when I realized that no matter what happens today, I am here because it's true, right? I mean, I think of the disciples, you know, Jesus is preaching hard messages and people are leaving and he asks the disciples, well, you're not going to leave too, are you? This sort of thing. And they say, well, where else are we going to go? I mean, you have the words of eternal life. I think they're grounded then in the right attitude. It's like, well, you've got the truth. So this is hard. You've said it was going to be hard, but it's true. So I where else am I going to go? And they stick with them. I think that really would revolutionize if we had that that foundational idea. That would revolutionize a lot of what we do in churches.
To refer to C.S. Lewis again, he argued at one point that a lot of churches go out and do group evangelism. He said, when you're doing this, let your arguers, people like you and I, go first when you engage. They're the ones that will deal with all the intellectual barriers that are keeping people from believing. Then let others go forward who have testimonies, and they can then give those testimonies. So it becomes, Jesus is true, here's why, and oh, here's also the impact that this truth has had on my life.
Right, right. Yeah, I just read that recently too, doing a little C.S. Lewis study, and yeah, that's exactly what he thought. There was a certain order to the way that he thought we should approach the culture, and I think of other quotes where he was asked to give a lecture about whether or not we can be good without God, something to this effect, right? Whether or not we can be moral, and he said, you know, it seems to me that. The person is asking the wrong question here. It seems to me that maybe they're not concerned with whether or not Christianity is true, and they need to remember that Christianity is not a medicine, but it claims to give an account of facts. And Lewis goes on to talk about foolish preachers who, by always telling you how good Christianity is for society, have forgotten that it claims to give an account of reality, right? And so, yeah, I'm with you, Nick. I think Lewis had the right approach there.
I think that essay is called Man or Rabbit, because it's the whole idea of, are we giving people a carrot or not?
Right, right.
And I'm thinking, in fact, that when we read our New Testaments and we hear about the apostles doing evangelism, we hear about the church fathers doing evangelism, we always see them focusing on what Jesus did himself, that Jesus rose from the dead, Jesus proclaimed himself to be king of the universe, Jesus is Lord right now, get in line. But our culture is self-focused. It becomes, well, what matters is what Jesus did for me. And I can't imagine the apostles taking that approach. And if they did that, someone would come and say, well, that's great, but Stoicism did that for me, and Epicureanism did that for me, and Platonism did that for me, and I see no need to align myself with a crucified Messiah against the Roman Empire just for something I'm getting it somewhere else.
Yeah, right. And you think about the early church. It's not like there was a ton of benefits involved with becoming a Christian, right? I mean, here, come be a Christian and be persecuted, part of the minority, and perhaps lose your livelihood and all these things. The cost of discipleship was very real and tangible to
those
followers.
And give up all those immoral practices that you have that you enjoy so much for a reward that you're not going to see at all in this lifetime.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So, yeah, I mean, there's it's hard because you don't want to be imbalanced in this. Again, like you said, of course we're out there. I mean, they're out there healing people, raising the dead, doing all these things. But the mindset is that it's because of the truth. You know, it's not a consumer product. It's because of the truth that we do these things. They are a sign of the truth. The truth is just you can't separate the truth of the message from all of this other stuff. And I think in our culture we've separated them too much. That, well, all right, we've got truth, we've got intellectual activity over here, and take it or leave it. But over here we've got the practical side of things. And well, no, I mean they have to go together. I don't think they really can be separated if you think about just a holistic view of reality.
And I'm also thinking that when we do this kind of thing, we can also make a mistake at what Coker says about promising things that Jesus himself never promised. I think, for instance, that I remember being in a church one time and hearing someone saying that, yeah, you should come to Jesus and don't let things hold you back, which, yeah, I agree with that. For instance, if you're struggling with something, he'll help you with it, and I agree with that part. He said, for instance, if you struggle with homosexuality, don't worry, just come to Jesus. He'll take care of that. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, oh my gosh, he did not just say that. Please tell me he did not just say that. Because I know of testimonies from some ex-homosexuals where, yes, that has happened. But I know of plenty more who have come to Christ and says, yeah, I came, but I haven't gotten past all my issues still. In fact, they're still there. My struggle is still there. I'm just practicing a celibate lifestyle, but I love Jesus. Some people don't find the change. Some people don't get cured of alcoholism or depression or anything else immediately. Some do. But we shouldn't make a promise when Jesus himself never made it.
Now, that's an excellent point, Nick. I mean, I think, I have a lot of friends in the evangelism community, sort of the traditional go out and preach at the festivals kind of community. And I mean, sometimes within that realm, I do sort of cringe at those messages. I'm with you that they stand up and say, I mean, with all the great intentions in the world, but they make the message basically, like you said, this is what Jesus did for me, and he will do it for you. And you're right, Nick, that doesn't always happen. There's no mention of the fact that you may be left with that struggle, or, you know, like we alluded to earlier, there's no mention of the fact that actually this may cause you some more issues, right? I mean, you may lose some friends over this. You do have to give up that boyfriend or the girlfriend or whatever. I mean, the cost of discipleship that comes with understanding the message as one of true or false, yeah, is missing from a lot of our messages, and I think that leads to, I mean, on one hand, we go out and preach that message, but then on the other hand, we're wondering why the church is somewhat shallow in America. That, well, you know, they're just not that deep necessarily. They've sort of got a surfacey faith. Well, we kind of brought them into that, didn't we? We kind of offered them a surfacey faith, I think. So, yeah, that's a great point.
I think the whole point I disagree with you on that is saying that the church is somewhat shallow. I think for most part, the church is completely shallow. in this regard, because we haven't taken discipleship very seriously. And to get to the other side of the coin, we're out there doing this kind of approach. The atheist community also say, well, Jesus did things for you that you like. Well, that's nice. Here are some things that I don't like. I don't like the God that I see in the Old Testament. I don't like the concept of hell. And if Jesus is doing so many good things for you, why did he let my brother die of cancer?
Right. That is, you know, all the skeptics that I've talked to over the years, primarily their objection, you nailed it, their objection is usually something they don't like about God. It's not that they actually have an argument for his non-existence or something like this, or actually good evidence to support some alternative worldview. It's that they don't like him. And this, again, I think it's kind of our fault, right? I mean, we've presented Jesus as someone that you should like, and then we say, well, they don't like him. Now what are we going to do? And so, yeah, that's a good point. And then on the other hand, I mean, I think as you were talking, I thought of Sam Harris. Here's a guy who, I mean, I don't think has any really great arguments, but it's interesting that I think it was the Letter to a Christian Nation at the beginning, or one section of that, He wrote, his first big book was The End of Faith, and a lot of Christians wrote to him saying something to the effect of, Sam, we don't think that the culture is going to be immoral if we don't have Christianity. We need some sort of standard, right? And he said, well, listen, even if atheism made the country completely immoral, even if it did, that wouldn't make me want to be a Christian because I want the worldview that's true. You know, Sam was sort of approaching the topic, at least in that paragraph, I thought properly, saying the issue should be truth. If you're just after morality, maybe we should be all Muslims. I mean, well, if it's just some sort of standard for living, we can grab that from various different places. He says, I want to know whether or not God actually exists. And now, again, I don't think he has great arguments, but I thought he approached that objection properly, saying, well, no, it's about true or false, right? It's not so much whether I like the culture to be more Christian or less Christian. It should be about truth. So, yeah, it's a big issue.
Yeah, it's what I usually call the argument from outrage, where you list all these litanies of things, for instance, like, here's all these genocides that took place in the Old Testament, on and on and on. And what happens usually in these conversations is the conversation goes away from talking about, here's what the data is, here's what the evidence is, to, let's talk about how we feel about the evidence.
Right, right.
So, now, if we assume this, before we go to our next commercial break, we're talking about truth, so give us a little bit of a start. How do you begin talking to the skeptic?
Well, generally what happens, at least in my situation, and this is not going to apply to everyone, but skeptics usually come to me and they'll have some sort of objection about Christianity. They don't like something about it. Every so often, maybe they have a reason to think it's false, but generally they have an objection. Like you said, what about the God in the Old Testament? What about these miracles? I mean, miracles don't happen. People don't walk on water. Virgins don't have babies, this sort of thing. And they'll want to talk about that. And so what I generally do is not talk about that. I'll explain that I'm glad to discuss that issue. But actually, I think we need to back up and make the topic broader to have a more fruitful discussion. And I will shift it towards a worldview discussion. And so how I do that is basically, you know, gently say, I'm glad to talk about that, but I think there's some deeper issues at play here, some deeper questions that need to be resolved before we can really talk about, you know, walking on water or the Old Testament God or whatever it is. We need to talk about what kind of world we live in. And after we have established that, if we can come to sort of an agreement on what kind of world we live in, or maybe we can't, but at least we'll have the issue out there, then we can talk about some of these other topics, because otherwise we're going to be talking past each other. I mean, if we start talking about miracles and you don't think they can happen, right, well, we need to establish that sort of thing first. So I do try to make the conversation about those big questions of life, like I mentioned before. How are we here, or why are we here? What happens when we die, and then everything in between? How should we then live? Why is there evil? That sort of thing. Make it about that rather than the objection that the skeptic has. Now, on the other hand, just before we go to break, if the skeptic doesn't have an objection and you're just trying to get into a conversation, well, then I do try to just discuss big questions of life. I mean, I think everybody's interested in the meaning of life. And it's fairly easy to get a conversation going in that direction by just, you know, bringing it up in regards to a movie you've watched or just something that's happened in the person's life. And those kind of conversations, I think, people are interested in. So rather than talk about Christianity or even talk about whatever objection they have, talk about the big issues. And that's how I try to start a conversation.
Okay, well, we are going to take that break right now, and I'm Nick Peters of Deeper Waters Christian Ministries. My guest is Don Johnson of Don Johnson Evangelistic Ministries, and we'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphones, and tablets. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
And we're back. My guest is Don Johnson of Don Johnson Evangelistic Ministries. We're talking about his book, How to Talk to a Skeptic. If you want to talk about it too, the call-in number is 714-242-5180. Now, Don, I can picture someone out there who's saying, well, you know, that's great that you're able to engage in those conversations that you've been studying for years. And, like, I want to study. I want to learn. I'm willing to listen to these podcasts and listen and read these books and such that you've recommended. You've piqued my curiosity. But I'm going to be going to the gym Monday, and I work out with my friend who's a very big atheist. He's very strong in his atheism. I don't know how I can speak to him without having done all this research first. So what do I do?
Yeah, and that is generally the problem. So that's a great question, Nick. We don't know how to – we're a little bit apprehensive about trying to answer any questions that they might have. Well, here's what I do. Now, I encourage people – some people just don't think they can study and they don't want to study, and you said, no, you're in a situation where you want to. That's great. And I suppose people who are listening to this podcast are already in that situation, so I applaud that. I think we do need to be equipping ourselves. But, like you said, maybe you don't, you know, you're not an expert. You don't have time to go into really, really deep study. How can you get into that conversation? The key, I think, at the beginning is to ask the right questions and do a lot of listening. And that will help direct the conversation where you want it to go. I don't even present really anything in the way of arguments or the gospel message or really anything up front until I have learned a lot about that person. What's their background? Like a little bit about them personally. You know, what's their background? Do they have some background in the church or with Christianity? Many strong atheists do, and that's why they're strong atheists. They've had a really bad experience and have been part of a odd group, perhaps. So learn about that, and then learn what they think is true, not about Christianity, although we're going to get to that in a minute. I think learn what they think is true about those big questions of life. So really direct the conversation toward learning what worldview the skeptic holds. They do hold one. They do have answers to the big questions of life. Chances are, though, they haven't thought about it all that deeply, and it's not coherent or cogent. And so it won't hold together all that well, and they probably haven't thought about it all that much. I mean, to be honest, I think most skeptics are just anti-Christian for the most part. They don't hold a positive view of anything. They just hold an anti-Christian view. So it's helpful to bring that out right up front. You know, you can say, listen, I understand you reject Christianity. All right, fair enough. But what have you found is true? I understand what you think is false, but tell me what you think is true. And that will generally be quite interesting. It'll help them think through, and if they do have a view, that's great. And if not, you can help them think through what it is they actually believe. Because ultimately, you want to compare that worldview to Christianity way down the line. But getting that view out there at first, I think, is vitally important. After you've learned a little bit about that, then you can ask them, all right, tell me what you think Christianity teaches, because I don't want to, you know, talk past you. I don't want to defend a view that you don't hold. So tell me what you think the Bible teaches, and how does Christianity answer the big questions of life as you understand it, right? And so asking all those types of questions, and we can expand on that if you want, Nick, but asking those type of questions first will generally open up a realm of conversation in which you don't have to really be a huge expert. You just have to be able to help that person think about what they believe. So it's not so much that you're the PhD, as nice as that is, but you don't have to be the PhD in Christian theology to get that person thinking about the big questions of life and starting to realize that maybe they're not standing on all of that firm a foundation. I think that's the first step towards a more productive conversation.
I'd like to start, Father, with something you said early on about how me and I'm just anti-Christian. Because as soon as you said that, the thing that popped into my mind immediately was so many atheists, for instance, hold this idea that Jesus never even existed. Which, if you went to any university or college and went to the Department of New Testament or the Department of Ancient History and told them that, they'd laugh at you. They'd say that's absolutely ludicrous to think something like that. And so many atheists hold a position, and I think they tend to hold it because if there's anything that could be reasonably said to be somewhat true about the Gospels, where we just can't allow that whatsoever. So there's this huge bias there that the standard of ancient historiography is applied to Jesus that isn't applied to anyone else.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's always struck me as really odd, too, Nick. I mean, Jesus didn't exist. I mean, where are you coming up with this stuff? I do think it shows that they're not really open to looking at the evidence and examining it with open mind, if you will. I mean, that's usually the charge towards Christians, isn't it? Is that, you guys don't look at the evidence, you don't like reason, you don't like to study history in depth. And, well, on that count, I mean, come on, we are the ones that are open-minded and looking at history, and let's be realistic, of course the guy existed. Now, in regards to Christianity, it's often very much, I think, like you said, an anti-intellectual view of Christianity. They haven't thought about it much. They don't know theology. They don't really know history that well. Now, some do. I don't want to, paint too broad a brush here. Obviously, some do. But in general, your average skeptic on the street, especially one that thinks Jesus doesn't exist, you can tell that, they haven't studied the issue really all that much. I do think you're right that is an attempt to maybe not have to study the issue in general all that much. I mean, if they know that little about early church history, for instance, and Roman Empire history, for instance, they probably haven't thought through much about a positive case for anything. And so, again, you can really help them to analyze, do you have a belief system that is well thought out and well defended? I really like to try to put at least a burden of proof on them at the beginning to not always have to be on the defensive, because Christianity does not have to be on the defensive. Both sides need to be able to explain and defend a view, I think.
The sad thing is, to be fair, that when we talk about them viewing Christianity as being anti-intellectual and anti-reason and such, the sad reality is there are too many Christians that do give that viewpoint off.
Yeah, I agree, Nick. That is unfortunate. Rebounded against the hard rationalism way too much, it seems like, or something. But yeah, you're right. I mean, we can't be putting our brains in our back pocket and just accepting things, without having some sort of reason and evidence. I mean, God's not anti-intellectual. We can go beyond reason. We're not rationalists, right? But at the same time, we accept reason. We're holistic realists, I think, right? And so, no, that's a good point. I mean, Christians do need to be more open to the life of the mind, I think.
Well, when we were talking with these people, you did bring up the burden of proof. Awesome. That is something important, I think, to consider, because it's always usually when you go to them that they'll say, well, you have the burden of proof. You're the one making the claim, and of course, as I've heard a few thousand times before, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a common one. And that's why I actually try to make the conversation about a comparison between worldviews. And so I'm not the one, you know, on the dock here. I'm not the one that's just, you know, on trial, and I'm not the only one making a claim. You're making a claim too, and you need to be able to explain and defend it. So by making the conversation about competing worldviews, and not just about, for instance, Christianity or some particular aspect of Christianity, which is what the conversations often are about, right? I mean, and that's fair enough. I mean, if we want to get into a conversation about, you know, the life of Jesus, okay, we can do that. But I do that later on. I start out with, we need to really compare your belief system to mine on a broad general level so that they understand that it's not just one person on trial here, and also that they understand that the burden of proof should be held by both sides of this discussion, and that they need to have some well-supported positions of their own. And if they don't, well, you know, I am not interested in just, I mean, if your claim is, for instance, I've had people, you know, claim, well, I don't have a worldview. You know, I don't hold beliefs. I'm agnostic about everything. But you make claims, and therefore, like you said, well, you have to defend them. No, I mean, if you don't know anything about anything, then you don't know anything about Jesus, and you don't know anything about Christianity, and so you're really not in a position to come in and have a debate. I mean, you've got to be able to stand on something. And so to the one who claims complete agnosticism about everything, well, you're not in a position to have that discussion then. Now, you need to make some claims here about something. And let me help you think through that, maybe. But, yeah, no, the extraordinary claims, there's so many presuppositions that go into that statement, right? Well, what do you mean by extraordinary? And what kind of world do we live in that it is an extraordinary claim? And do those really require a different kind of evidence and this sort of thing? By making the conversations about worldviews, we can avoid some of those traps that are laid for Christians, I think.
Yeah, I often refer to it as a form of atheistic presuppositionalism, where it comes out as, our worldview is the true one. It explains reality, and there's nothing extraordinary about it, but everything that you believe is extraordinary because it disagrees with our worldview. And I can say, well, look, I consider the claim that God doesn't exist to be pretty extraordinary, so I think you need to provide some good evidence for that. And then just try and have a little bit of fun and say, Saz, what exactly do you mean by extraordinary evidence? How do you recognize extraordinary evidence? Does it glow? What?
Right, right. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. The presuppositionalism on the atheistic side, yeah, that's exactly right. And too often, again, we fall into the trap of playing on their playing field. You know, if we accept their presuppositions, well, you're never going to get to the end of that conversation. That's never going to end well, right? If you're accepting their presuppositions and playing on their playing field, well, it's no surprise if that doesn't go all that great, right? That's why I generally refuse to jump too quickly into very specific topics, because the presuppositions that you hold coming in are going to skew this, and I'm not willing to play on that field. Because reality is not that. I mean, why? You know, it's like, I use the beach analogy. We're out here in Huntington Beach, and so we spend a lot of time on the sand. And I use the analogy of looking for stuff on the beach. Well, if you come out there with a metal detector, looking for metal, all right, fair enough. That's a good way to find metal, and I'll join you in that quest and make use of your metal detector, right? But if you're out there looking for something else in the beach, paper or, you know, whatever, people, and you just want to use your metal detector, and you think that I should only use the metal detector, yet we're debating whether or not there's any other people, for instance, on the beach, or whether there's any paper hidden in the sand, well, that we're never going to find it, because we're only using a metal detector. So playing on the atheistic, materialistic playing field like that, that's never going to work out, right? You've got to expand the conversation.
Edward Fesser has used the exact same analogy before, and it definitely applies to people who have a scientism mindset. Science is our greatest way of knowing truths about the universe, and I even had someone recently in a Facebook debate saying that we have to go as science because when it comes to history, we weren't there, so it just becomes a position of faith, and then it started to meet. And where the writing back then would have been difficult because most people were illiterate, and I responded, hold on a second, you weren't there just where I go, so you said we can't know things, but somehow you're able to know that most people were illiterate. I'm curious, which one is it going to be for you? Either you weren't there and you don't know and we can't know, or you do make some sort of claims about history. If you just go with a scientism mindset, you're not going to be able to know anything about history or morality or so many other things in life.
Yeah, they don't generally, a lot of the scientism position is it's self-refuting, I think, but at best it's not livable, right? I mean, even if you could somehow philosophically support it, which I don't think you can. Yeah, you're right. They don't, if scientism was true, we couldn't possibly be out here arguing about this stuff, whether it's be history or anything else, frankly. So, yeah, and by the way, I love Fezzer. I think he's a great scholar. That very well may be where I have got that analogy and just forgot it. So thanks for bringing that up.
Okay, so now we're discussing these questions and the big worldview questions. So let's suppose they come to you then, and you're not the most educated person, will say, okay, so what do you really believe? And why should I believe it? What do you recommend saying then?
Yeah, now at this point, you know, once you've got to having them explain the world as they understand it and telling the story of the world as they understand it, this is a situation where you do, I think, need to have, at least in a general sense, the story of the world according to Christianity. How does Christianity answer those big questions of life? How we got here? What went wrong? And really, it's I think a 3 or 4 part drama. You know, we've got creation, the fall, redemption, and future fulfillment, or just creation, fall, redemption. But either way, there's some just basic, simple points that you could really tell in story form to answer that question. So we were created, you know, to love God. Love is what the meaning of life is, I think. And we decided to love something else. Our great-great-great-great-great grandparents, Adam and Eve, loved something else and broke that relationship. And we were separated because that's what adultery does. Adultery separates relationships, intimate ones, and they're no longer intimate. And so that the history of the world is resolving that relationship. I think God's plan of redemption is to bring us back into intimate relationship, and therefore he has recreated and continues. I think the story of the world is one of creation, fall, and then redemption. I actually generally call it new creation. Same thing as what everybody else means, but I think it's kind of helpful for the skeptic to see it as this plan of new creation, and the plan of new creation continues with the new Adam, the new heaven, the new earth. Jesus is the new Adam, and there's a bunch of prefiguring. And, of course, I spent a lot of time on this, and we can discuss it if you want, but I do spend the middle part of the book, several chapters, just going over this creation and new creation story and where Jesus fits in to help the readers understand, I think, the story of the Bible in more of a story form and in more of a big picture form so that they can then share it with the skeptic in an easy to follow way, because I do think a lot of times we tend to have more of a dry systematic approach to Christianity that the skeptic doesn't understand or finds it more easy to reject. So yeah, I make it a love story. I think we should understand Christianity as a love story, and when we do, I think it makes better sense of some of the objections that the skeptic is going to have, things like why God requires worship and why sacrifice would be involved and what part Jesus does play and why he had to die. All of those things make sense, I think, within that broader love story.
Well, we're going to go ahead and take a little bit early our third break. I'm Nick Peters with Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Don Johnson of Don Johnson Evangelistic Ministries. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
And we're back. I'm Nick Peters, and our call-in number is 714-242-5180 if you want to talk to my guest, Don Johnson of Don Johnson Evangelistic Ministries. But next week, my guest is going to be Tom Gerson of Thinking Christians, and we're going to be talking about Peter Boghossian. Not sure if you've heard about this guy, but he's written a book recently called A Manual for Creating Atheists. I've read it. Yes, it's not a very good book at all, and I don't think it's going to create a lot of atheists except for people who are already leaning that way, and the arguments are quite weak. In fact, if you go to his Facebook page, I've been enjoying a fair share of fun there, interacting with the atheists. But he's going to be my guest next week. In fact, he's a reason. I mean, Tom Gerson is going to be my guest next week, talking about Peter Boghossian, and there's a reason for that. Also, is because Boghossian has a show that he's going to have come on called The Reason Whisperer, where he's going to go out and film conversations in an attempt to deconvert people and play them publicly, to which my response has been, please come to my church. Please, please, please do come to my church. That's what's going on. Have you? I'm guessing you've probably heard about this guy too, haven't you, Don?
I have, Nick. I haven't read the book yet, but I'm a big fan of Tom Gilson and his compilation book, True Reason. And so that would be great. I would love for Peter to come to your church and talk about the basis for rationality and who has a more reasonable view. That would be entertaining to me. So yeah, let's hope that happens.
Yeah, you know, I'm pretty sure that episode would never ever air, even though it's supposed to be live. But anyway, you talk about the love story going on, and that gets us to a point also I think we should focus a good bit of time on, since so many objections focus on this, and that's the Christian view of the Bible.
Yeah, the Bible is a big one. A lot of, correct me, you know, tell me which direction you want us to go with this topic, Nick, but I do have a chapter talking about the Bible, and the reason I brought it up in the book, and actually my publisher we went back and forth on it. He says, you know, I think it's a good chapter. I think it's fine. I don't want people to misunderstand, and so we tried to finesse it a little bit. And again, I try to make a point. I hope people don't understand. I do think sometimes we treat the Bible, we put it in a category that we think is good, you know, like we don't want to disrespect the Bible as Christians. We want to be Bible Christians, and we want to use it as an authority, and hey, I'm right there with you. But sometimes we put it in a category that it doesn't actually belong, and it has the inverse effect of what we want. We want the Bible to draw people to Jesus, but we have the inverse effect of actually using the Bible to keep God at somewhat of a distance. And I start out that chapter with a quote or a section from the Da Vinci Code. And in the Da Vinci Code, there's a point there where the protagonist talks about why he believes that Christianity is false and why the Bible's not a book from God. It's not a divine book. It's not scripture. There's nothing inspired about it. And he says, we know it's not because it was written by man. It didn't fall down as a fax from heaven. Now, I look at that and say, well, yeah, of course it was written by man. Of course it's not a fax from heaven. You know, it is an account of a particular time and a particular place, and I agree with that, and I think all Christians should agree with that. But he understood it as, well, if that's true, you know, if there's any human element to this book, then it can't be from God. And so I unpack that a little bit because skeptics do approach the Bible that way a lot of times. Probably as a result of maybe some well-meaning Christians who have misunderstood, I think. And then they look at it and they say, well, look, you know, the way this book was written, you know, this particular book, maybe part of the Gospels or maybe part of the Old Testament. I mean, there's many human elements to this. The author clearly had an objective in place, and he finessed history to make a point here. And I look at that, reading it as literature, and I say, yeah, that's right. The author clearly did have a point. And yes, that history was written in the way that people wrote history in those days. Doesn't mean it's false, but it's not the way we necessarily write history. And so I accept the human element in it, but that doesn't mean for me that it's not divine. It's both fully human and fully divine. It's an incarnational thing in a similar way, not the same way, but in a similar way to Jesus is fully God and fully man. I think Scripture is both. And we can hold it as both. Oftentimes, I think what happens is we make it too divine, if that makes sense. We put it on this place where we say, well, no, there's really no human element to it. And so I don't have to study it as literature. I don't have to look at the historical context. I don't have to look at the genre of the literature. I don't have to do any of the stuff that we would normally do with a human book. I can just read it as the literal words of God, and by literal, they generally mean something, you know, strange, where you're not looking at it in a normal way, but in this hard way, where I mean, I gave some, there's some silly examples out there from skeptics who say, for instance, well, the Bible talks about snakes eating dirt, and, well, we know snakes don't eat dirt, so therefore, the Bible is false. Well, come on, I mean, everybody who can read anything realizes that that's somewhat pictorial, right? I mean, it's somewhat allegorical. We're talking about certain characteristics of snakes and all the rest of it, but it doesn't necessarily have to mean that snakes eat dirt. Well, this person comes back and says, well, no. If it's the Word of God, that means that snakes have to eat dirt. So they're not reading it as properly, right, as a human document, the way we'd normally read it. They think it has to be in the separate category. And so I try to discuss that a little bit. Where does the Bible actually fit into God's revelation? What's its purpose? Can we account for the human element of it? Can we do historical criticism on the Bible without thinking that it's not inspired? Absolutely. I think we can do good scholarship on it. And this actually will, I mean, the Bible should be a means to an end. It should bring us to Jesus. It should lead us towards God. It's not an end in and of itself. We don't want to be like the religious leaders that Jesus reprimanded for saying that you search the Scriptures because you think in them you have eternal life, but you refuse to come to me. We don't want to be biblicists in that sense. We want to use the Bible to get to Jesus, and we want to make sure that skeptics realize that they should be using the Bible to get to Jesus. And the way we interact with it intellectually has a lot to do with whether or not they're going to get there. That's a quick overview of that chapter. I go into much more depth actually in the book.
Yeah, when you were talking about passages they take literally, one that comes to my mind that the optimists use so much is Luke 14, where it says, Jesus says, you're supposed to hate your mother and father. And every time I hear that, I just think, really? You really think Jesus is commanding hatred of your parents?
Right. Yeah, that's a good example. I mean, clearly in the context, he's not saying, you know, hate in the sense that we normally think of hate, right? I mean, that just doesn't make any sense at all if you read it within the context of Jesus' teaching and even within the context of that little passage right there. It's about the cost of discipleship and what it means to love Jesus. And indeed, I write about that, and that particular passage does come up in the chapter on love. But you're right. You can't read the book so anti-intellectually, which is what they're doing, so anti-intellectually that you think that particular use of the word hate is contradictory to other teachings of Jesus, right? And so, yeah, that's a good example.
What I always say about atheists when it comes to the Bible is that for the most part, not all of them, but for the most part, most of them are fundamentalist atheists just as much as they are fundamentalist Christians. Each of the fundamentalist Christians and the fundamentalist atheists each approach the Bible the exact same way. It's supposed to be a fact from heaven, supposed to be divine, everything. You don't need to study the greater context, and everything is to be interpreted literally. The only difference is the Christian believes it all, the atheist disbelieves it all.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. I couldn't agree more. And often they're more fundamentalists than even the hardest core fundamentalists on the Christian side. Yeah, they're coming up with interpretations that you have to shake your head at. You're like, well, what is that? And I mean, even sometimes they'll say, well, we don't even interpret the Bible. We just read it and do, you know, accept it at face value, which of course is, again, nonsensical. There's no such thing as non-interpreting a text. You have to interpret it. But yeah, you're absolutely right, Nick.
And it's also become to the point that I remember hearing someone on the Unbelief Bar Show, may have the Greer Christian program going on, who was saying that where the Bible gives two contradictory accounts, supposedly, on how Judas died, so how can we trust anything historically in the Bible? And I was just on my end getting ready to scream into my the podcast, we were saying, really? Because if we went by this standard of saying that if we see any contradiction in a work of ancient history, then we have to throw the whole thing out. We pretty much throw out everything at that point. It didn't seem to occur to this person that, yeah, even if there was hypothetically a contradiction, it doesn't mean the whole thing is totally unreliable.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Nick. And sometimes, you know, when I debate New Testament, I remember I had this extended debate with Robert Price many years ago, and he wanted to attack that fundamentalist position. And I did not even, you know, as much as I hold to the inspiration and inerrancy, I actually said I don't need to present that as one of my arguing points. I said, all I'm arguing for in my defense, we were debating the resurrection, if I remember correctly. So that was the topic. And, of course, then it gets into the reliability of the New Testament. But I said, actually, you know, all of the errors that you bring up, I mean, most of them, my position does not depend on those errors actually being inerrant, right? So even if there are those contradictions, this is the point you're making. As Christians, we have good answers for those, and the Bible, I do believe, is inerrant according to the standard of first century history, and so all of that I accept, but you actually don't even need to have that and I hesitate to use the word defeat or anything, because we're not in a fight, but the skeptical position falls without those. We can hold to Jesus being who he says he was without resorting to having to answer all those apparent contradictions. Because I think I defended a position I called non-literal history. As long as the main point of the history, the way they wrote ancient history, as long as the main point, which was clearly that Jesus was the Jewish Messiah, as long as you can accept that the authors wanted to say that, that's all I need, you know. And I don't need to worry about all of your apparent contradictions. I'll grant them, you know, even though I don't believe them, I'll grant them for the sake of it. And so, yeah, I think you're making a good point there, Nick, that you don't need to get too deep into the weeds there trying to deal with all those, even if there is a few errors. And I don't think there is, but even if there was, Christianity doesn't rise or fall based on those.
Yes, I've even seen some Christians who've said, and I've talked about this with Ali before, and said it terrifies me when I see this, but they'll say, if there's one contradiction in the Bible, the whole thing is false, Christianity's false, and Jesus didn't rise from the dead. So that position frightens me to no end. It's not because I don't think that the Bible can be defended from error. I think it can be, but what you're requiring people to do when you make inerrancy such a stronghold is they have to carry around in mind an answer to every single Bible contradiction that could possibly be out there. And really, I don't think anyone is equipped to carry an answer every single one out there. And you're having your entire faith hang on, say, how many stars of horses Solomon might have had.
Right, right. No, that is an excellent point. It's very dangerous. I mean, there's an epidemic of Christian kids going off to college right now and running into people like Bart Ehrman and others who do question that hard literalist position that says, if there's any errors in this thing, then Christianity is false. And they're getting shaken. I mean, I'm just running to this constantly. Oh, what about this? What about this? And you're right. I mean, we can't set up that position where because it's not about ultimately the inerrancy of Scripture. The Bible is one part of a much bigger package. And this is a point I try to make quite extensively in the book, is that, listen, the Bible is part of a broader package of revelation, if you will. I mean, it's part of what God's doing, but it's not the only thing. He didn't just show up 2,000 years ago and drop a book out of the clouds and say, there it is, that's it, you know, you're done. I mean, 2 seconds worth of thought should help us realize, oh, no, I mean, that's not even what he did 2,000 years ago. He brought Jesus, right? I mean, Jesus came to earth. Yes, that's the pinnacle of Revelation, and even that's not the full extent of it, right? That's the fulfillment of it. And so, I mean, they didn't have the Bible as we know it then, yet they have the revelation of God. So we need to start thinking about revelation and how God interacts with humankind. I think we need to think about that on a broader level and not be so reliant on thinking that the Bible is this facts from heaven and that it's the only thing that God does to reveal himself. We need to sort of broaden our horizons, I think, a little bit to think about how God does interact with us. I think it does go, I mean, as central, of course, as Scripture is. It goes beyond that, I think.
As fortunate as we are today, we do have the New Testament, and we can use it. We need to keep in mind that for the first Christians, there wasn't a New Testament. They only had what they'd seen and heard from Jesus, which... We shouldn't say they only have it, because that's much more than what we've got, really. They had the eyewitness testimony. We only have what they wrote about that. And then they had the Hebrew Bible together, and they still went out and did evangelism. And the fact that they did all that, it's not going to change if, for instance, Matthew and Luke can't seem to agree on whether the centurion or his servants came to see Jesus.
Right, yeah. No, that's exactly right. I'm with you 100% on that one, Nick.
And I do agree with you that we're putting way too much on our youth, and Craig Evans has written about Bart Ehrman and says that Bart Ehrman, he talks about that story where he turned in a paper on Mark 2 to resolve a contradiction, and the professor just went, maybe Mark just made a mistake. And you can tell it's a shaping event for Ehrman, because he writes about it in nearly every single book he writes. And Craig Evans, when he looks at it, says, I can't help but think that Ehrman overreacted to something, that he put too many eggs in one basket, and when that basket fell apart, there was nothing more that he could do.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That has always been my impression, too, of Ehrman's story, is that he had so much tied up into a very hard literalist view of Scripture and its role in Revelation, that when that, you know, pebble fell out and the idea that there might be a mistake in it just crumbled his faith. I mean, yeah, you're right, that's way too much. But those are the kind of kids, I mean, it's kids that do have that attitude that Ehrman is he's destroying their faith as well with his books, because, I mean, he makes some good points about, you know, different things, and you can read that. I mean, even Robert Price, I mean, I talked about Price earlier, and, you know, he's got some, you know, wacky views, but it was very helpful to me. That was quite early on in my ministry, and it was very helpful to me to read his stuff and how he dealt with the Bible issue and the different apologetic approaches, and so I had to kind of immerse myself. It was very helpful to me to realize that, oh yeah, you know, actually, if I had gone down that track, he could have undercut me, and rightly so, you know. So that was a major turning point for me, I think, that extended debate I had with him, in realizing that some of these foundational issues that I thought, at least that I thought were foundational, were not so much yet. Christianity still stood without them. And so, yeah, we need to be providing our kids with that broader foundation so that, you know, if they do sense that, oh, you know, how do we deal with this contradiction? Well, one, we can, but two, it's not as big a deal as you might think it is.
You know, one thing that I did was, I think it was last year, I taught a class for a church in Indiana via Skype, and I used Jim Wallace's Cold Case Christianity as the book for that class. And so many times when we'd have a discussion come up and we'd discuss an objection I was raised, one of my favorite answers to any objection the class came to realize this after a while was, so what? Well,
yeah.
There's this contradiction in the Bible. So what? Well, Jesus didn't do such and such. So what? Because my point is, okay, let's suppose I grant you that, Mr. Skeptic. What does that really prove anyway?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I do a similar thing on a broader level with skeptics that I talk to. They will have, you know, some sort of objection to Christianity, and particularly the ones that came out of the church. And so they'll tell me about, a little bit about their story, and maybe they had a fight with somebody, or they found some contradiction in Scripture. And I'll ask them, so let me get this straight. This worldview that has all of this going for it, that you're telling me that worldview was decimated by either A, the tiff you had with that other Christian, or B, this somewhat small contradiction that you found. I mean, did that really crumble this whole edifice? And because of that, you found something? I mean, yeah, getting it just isn't that, right? Those small things a lot of times are not that important. And so spending so much time, I mean, let's say you did get into a discussion over, you know, the date of the Last Supper or something, right? And because, you know, there's some debate on that. And so, the skeptic just can't see how it can be brought together. And all right, fair enough. Are they abandoning Christianity because of that? Well, no. And if you have put all of your eggs in the discussion, in that basket, and you can't defend it, well, now what are you going to do? Right, so that's why I try to avoid those discussions, particularly at the beginning, and have the bigger issues up front, because you don't want to get caught in a smaller issue that doesn't really matter anyway.
We're going to take a break right now. I'm Nick Peters with Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Don Johnson of Johnson Evangelistic Ministries. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gift if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And we're back, and yes, I do want to remind you all that we are listener-supported. And if you want to support Deeper Waters, you can find out how at our blog at deeperwaters.wordpress.com. You can support us through Tectonics, through Risen Jesus, through Ratio Christi Issues and Answers chapter. You just need to let each of those people know, hey, I want to support Nick Peters, I want to support Deeper Waters, and they'll make sure we're taken care of here. But also, guys, let me give you a big tip here. Valentine's Day is coming up. Now, we all want to do something very good if we've got women in our lives. We want to do something very nice for them. And I can tell you, I'm sure Don would definitely agree with me on this, women tend to like jewelry. So if you're wanting to get your lady something special in the line of jewelry, let me give you a tip here. Go to Lena Clester, LaynaClester at mypremierdesigns.com. She's working with us, and if you order from her and say, hey, I want to support Deeper Waters, she said 25% of everything you purchase will go straight to us. Which means if you buy that necklace for $40 for your wife, $10 of that goes to support Deeper Waters Ministries. I mean, how can you beat a deal like that? You get to show your wife how much you love her, and you support a great ministry at the same time. At least I hope you think it's a great ministry. We could really use your support to keep doing what we're doing here. And now, Don, you've got your own ministry. How can people support that as well if they want to do that?
Yeah, we are in very much the same position, Nick. Don Johnson Ministries is a fully listener and just general person supported ministry. So I rely on the goodness and donations of others. And so we are a 501c3 registered out here in California. And yeah, similar thing. If you want to go to donjohnsonministries.org, you can hit the donate button, and there are several options there where you can help the ministry. There's also, just to throw in a little extra, if you are, for instance, more inclined to help overseas ministries, and I know some people are, and that's fair enough, we actually do have a partnership in India where we train local pastors and help them to plant churches. And so we actually will, if you'd like to adopt a pastor in India, you can donate through Don Johnson Ministries, and it will go directly over to our partner, the Indian Council of Missions, over in India. And so there's lots of ways to support the ministry, either here or in India. But, yes, we all need help always. Like I said, I know a lot of evangelists and all people like Nick who have apologetics ministries. And, you know, it takes money to keep all this stuff on the air. So I would encourage you to support Nick and all the rest of us. And I like that jewelry thing, Nick. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it's very good to have friends who are willing to do that kind of thing. And it's a fascinating story about how we met this lady, but she's really behind us, really likes to encourage and support us. Max, she's the one who told us about the Johnny and friends in the area, and that eventually got us to the Miss Shining Star pageant, which, as I said, my wife won the first one last month. So, yeah, I can say on Valentine's Day, everyone say, yes, I am married to a beauty queen now.
That's awesome.
Now, I'd like to talk about something else you talk about in your book, another chapter, because it's a common objection that comes up. And that's the mystery religions, things like Mithras, Horus, Osiris, and such. And you and I definitely take different positions on this one. And you could probably excuse in my case, since I'm more historically inclined and such. For me, I like to go straight to the jugular and say, these claims are baloney, here's why. But you take a different approach, don't you?
You know, and I do, but for me, I think there's two reasons. One, I'm not as historically inclined, so I'm not the expert historian like you are, Nick, and like others. And so, you know, for those guys, it's not that I don't think that's a great way to go. but I think it's not the only way, basically. I mean, I agree. For instance, I mean, let me set this up. So you've got all these mystery religions. You've got all these apparent similarities between pagan myths and the gospel story. And if you really look at them in detail, well, they're not that similar, right? I mean, you can knock them down. A lot of the supposed similarities just aren't there. And historically, I just don't think there's any way. I mean, there's many ways historically, I think, to knock down the idea that the Gospels were written based on these other stories. I mean, not the least of which, and this is the one I generally use if I'm in a historical debate, not the least of which is, hey, these guys are Jews, all right? These are Jews thinking that there's a Jewish Messiah. If you think that they are going to steal from myths in order to make up a mythical character, I mean, you just don't understand Judaism. I mean, that's just, there's no way that they would have a non-historical, mythical Messiah. Just not going to happen within Judaism. So that's generally the tack I take if I go historically. Now, a lot of people, though, are like me, and they're not that historically inclined, right? They have this general idea of the maybe a dying and rising God or a God figure who descends to the earth to help people who are in darkness, this kind of thing. And if that's their take on it, it seems like Jesus is sort of like these other superheroes, right? I mean, it kind of does. And, I mean, even our modern superheroes even Superman, and I'm not a comic book guy. I'm not even a big movie comic hero guy. But I know that, you know, hey, the Superman movies, a lot of similarities, right? A lot of similarities to Jesus. And, you know, people have on a general level, they see those similarities. Well, I tend to just affirm them. Say, yeah, all right, fair enough. Yeah, those, I think they are similar. And, I mean, it makes more sense. You could say that Superman, of course, is stealing from the Gospels, which I think is more accurate. But guys like George Lucas with his Star Wars figures and even the Indiana Jones, I mean, Lucas himself, he was reading a lot of myths, and he tried to integrate a lot of the ancient myths into his stories, and he admits that, you know, openly. Well, you do look at some of those historical myths, and I see some parallels. I mean, I even point one out in the book, just a simple one like Plato's Cave, where the savior figure shows the slaves hidden in Plato's Cave that they're looking at shadows and not the real thing, and they kill him, and he is not welcome. And, well, Jesus, you know, there's some parallels there. I tend to affirm those parallels, but then go on to say that they are fulfilled in the Jesus story. It's not that the gospel writers were stealing from them. It's that they all point towards Jesus, and that the Jesus story is very much set in space and time, and it has to be. And that's where I might bring in the Jewish stuff about it. It just doesn't make sense that the Jews were stealing from pagan myths. What actually happened, and then I talk about Revelation in general. I mean, if we look at the story of God, the story of redemption, if you will, the story of all of the world, well, was God silent between the time that he created or even the time that Adam and Eve fell? Was he completely silent until the time that Jesus came? No, clearly he was not, right? I mean, and not even just with Abraham and the children of Israel, but in general Revelation. Romans 1 assures us that the heavens declare the glory of God. And so it makes sense to me that there would be some knowledge of God throughout the whole world. And I think if you look sociologically, and this, I am a little bit more aware of this kind of thing, and studying ancient tribes and the way people believe around the world, well, those parallels, I think, make best sense if they are actually interacting with an objective reality. And by that, I mean, if you look at all the different myths around the world from pre-Jesus tribes, right, so the pagan tribes from all over the world, they have many similarities in their belief systems, not the least of which is one creator God in general. They're not actually polytheists in the strict sense. Usually they believe in one true God above the pantheon of gods that they deal with on a day-to-day basis. And often that one true God is one that they have offended in some way. And that's why they don't talk to him on a day-to-day basis, because they are alienated from him in some way. So they deal with this pantheon of smaller gods, and often they are cruel and capricious and unjust. But if you look at how they worship and what they do, I mean, there's a lot of parallels in those myths and the ancient pagan belief systems. Well, I suggest, you know, I go with more of a G.K. Chesterton, C.S. Lewis approach to this. I would suggest that what we see there is some shadows, it makes good sense if those people are reacting with the general revelation that is available to all people at all times, and that in interacting with those, they come up with some parallel, some myth that they're not true, but yet they're not devoid of fact, right? And when it comes to Jesus then, as Lewis said, that's those myths become fact. That's the heart's desire of those people, the truth that they're trying to get to, is put in time and space in a stable in Bethlehem, you know, 2,000 years ago. And so I try to affirm, you know, if they see some parallels, I'll say, yeah, the parallels. But in fact, it's not because the Gospels stole from the myths. What actually happened was the myths were a reflection of the eternal Gospel, the Gospel that was made flesh in Jesus. And so the Jesus story is the myths put into time and space in a more, in the ultimate real way, if you will. And, you know, like it's not the only way to approach that myth thing, but it's a way that I found is helpful to some people.
And I think that's really important, because not everyone does know all these facts about these myths and such. But if you don't know them, well, okay, here is something else you can say. And also I can tell people, if they're getting their information, this kind of thing, from a source like, say, the History Channel, for instance,
right.
Please don't take it seriously. The History Channel is some of the worst programs you will ever see on the Bible. It's usually become, let's take the most fringe positions we can and go out there and present them as if they were mainstream. But
right.
I really liked what you were saying, because Lewis said that Christianity was true myth, in essence.
Right.
And I like G.K. Chesterton's line. He used the everlasting man, but if you're going to say that this is borrowing because the stories are so similar, I mean, you might as well be saying that the great flood and the baptism of John are the same event, because they both involve people going underwater.
Right. Yeah, no, that's right. You got to look at what's the more solid story, what's the reality, and what are the shadows. And I think often that the skeptics will approach it from the wrong way. They'll say, well, we've got this solid pagan myth and then the shadowy story in Jesus. Well, no, not really. It's the other way around. The shadowy story is the myth, and then the Jesus story is the real thing. that the myth was pointing towards. And so, yeah, that's those are great quotes.
Yeah, and you'll find most people, if you ask them about these myths, they don't really know much about them. I've been engaging with someone on Boghossian's Facebook page who's been trying to put this idea, and I've asked four or five times now, at least, over and over, where are the Mithraic scriptures? Where are the Mithraic scriptures? Can you show them to me? And I have gotten no acknowledgement whatsoever, even, of that question. I think it's, again, the anti-Christian bias that shows up with people who say, I haven't looked into this, I haven't studied this, but it disagrees with Christianity, so I'm going to take it and run with it as...
Yeah, that sums it up, Nick. That's a great way of putting it. They'll grab onto whatever. It doesn't really matter as long as it has some sort of appearance of objection to Christianity or some way to validate their own faith, their own biases, even if it's not based in fact at all. So that's a good point.
Yeah, I've tended to tell people that if a person won't believe the truth, here's what they will believe. They'll believe anything else whatsoever, and they'll go to any port in a storm, and when I've met these people, they haven't really engaged with the primary scholarship on the issue, and these kinds of fads, just like the idea that Jesus never existed, they only become popular on the internet. And I was telling my wife a few week or so ago when we were driving together, I said, "And you know why this is? Here's why. Imagine going to all these family reunions, and over there in the corner is weird Uncle Bob. Okay, no one really talks with Bob because Bob has these strange ideas. Everyone loves him, but he's just considered bizarre. Well, guess what happens when you get the internet? You get a bunch of weird uncles that never get to talk to anyone else, and all of a sudden they have a platform where they can share their ideas. And people would believe it because, hey, you know, I read it on the internet, and, you know, if you read it on the internet, it must be true."
Yeah. The internet is an interesting thing, isn't it, Nick? I know you're better at interacting via comments and stuff than I am. I find I don't really have the personality, I think, to interact well in comment section. Now, but you make a good point about what the internet tends to do with its, I mean, it's one thing to do it on Facebook with a person that has their name and everything there, and that's, I think, the best of the options to me. But a lot of times these anonymous comments and people anonymously just spouting off on all sorts of stuff, I never feel the need to engage with that. I will actually, if people comment, I'll actually give them my email and actually give them my phone number privately, saying, if you want to interact with this, I'd be glad to actually chat with you, get your name and chat with you on the phone. And I understand maybe people don't necessarily want to call, but I have hardly ever been taken up on that, even to the point of not getting an email address, right? So, beware. I think your point about just being aware of what you read on the internet is good. Being aware of how you interact on the internet is also good. I know that sports writers are famous for getting all sorts of crazy comments, right? I mean, sports fans are sports fans, and they'll say anything on the internet. But I've actually seen stories where the sports writer, he reads something that's so offensive and so silly that he feels like tracking that down. And so he tracks the person down and gives them a call. Inevitably, the person is, you know, this nice family man who was very apologetic and didn't really mean what he said. It's just that it was anonymous, so he just spouted off. And, you know, just sort of beware of that, I guess, when you're interacting with skeptics on the internet. It's a crazy world out there.
And when you're talking about the things that you read on the internet, something I also tell people is don't rely on Wikipedia. If I meet someone and their source over and over is Wikipedia, I say, forget it. You need to present me some books, some real scholars in the field. Those I take seriously. Wikipedia was written, it could have been written by a PhD, that entry could have, or it could have been written by a 15-year-old in high school. We don't know. Right. So why should I take it seriously?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right.
Well, we're going to go ahead in at this. It's a little bit early. We're going to take our last break. And when we come back, there's one other topic I'd like to discuss with Don and get his feedback on it. I'm Nick Peters. This is The Deeper Waters. Radio Show, and my guest is Don Johnson of Don Johnson Evangelistic Ministries. We'll be back after this break.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show, free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That, again, is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
And we're back. My guest is Don Johnson of Don Johnson Evangelistic Ministries. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. And I'd like to end this with a discussion of a kind of doubter that shows up here. And I'm going to be talking about what's the start of one of the chapters of your book where there was an apologetics talk going on that Frank Turek witnesses, and this young man comes up and says, "I once was a Christian, but now I'm an agnostic, and I don't think you should be doing what you're doing." He says, "I don't think you should be giving arguments against atheists," the young man says. "Jesus told us to love, and what you're doing is not loving." And the apologist starts to answer the objection, but he was met with several more over and over, until finally the apologist turns and says, "You're raising all these objections because you're sleeping with your girlfriend. Am I right?" And Oliver Carter apparently drains McKidd's face, and he's caught immediately. Now, you don't recommend doing this kind of technique, but it does show the kind of doubt that exists out there, doesn't it?
Oh, it really does. And I did want to – that's the last biggest chapter, the last main chapter in the book, and I think I called it Hypocrisy, Sex, and Other Causes of Skepticism or something like that. The idea that there are other factors beyond intellectual doubt at play within skepticism. So that skeptic that you're talking to, I mean, you may have – really good answers to every objection. You may have got them to think accurately about their views, and they understand Christianity correctly, and I mean, you've done everything right, yet they still won't believe what's going on there. Well, there's a lot of other factors that could be at play, and yeah, the immorality, and I think in particular sexual immorality, is a huge one. And I've run into this myself.
Yes.
I mean, I've worked college the idea that, in fact, I had a girl in my office with some friends, and she was, you know, I don't have a really good relationship with God, and, you know, I kind of maybe want one, but I'm really not sure, and I don't know, and I got to talking to her, and it turns out that she indeed was not just sleeping with her boyfriend, but she had moved in with him and was living with him. I said, "Well, do you think that that's going to have to change at all? Do you think there's going to have to be some changes there, you know, in your situation?" "Well, I guess if you follow Jesus, and do you think that might be playing a part in your decision?" "Oh, definitely," she said, "you know, definitely. I just don't think I can do that. I don't think I can follow Jesus if it means that I have to move out or give up my boyfriend." And she wasn't even a skeptic in the sense that she didn't believe God exists. At some level, she even wanted, as she claimed, a relationship with God. She was actually concerned about her personal walk with Jesus. But at the root, I said, "Well, how do you expect to have a close personal walk with Jesus when you refuse to stop sleeping with your boyfriend and living with him? I mean, that's just not going to happen, is it?" She kind of didn't quite get that. And I don't think she did move out. I never actually saw her again after that counseling session. And so, yeah, this aspect that there's more at work here within skepticism, I wanted to spend some time on it in the last chapter, and immorality for one thing, rationalizing away your immorality in a form of skepticism, I think, is a big one, that you want there not to be a God because you don't want to have to change your behavior. So if there was a God, I'd have to change. Therefore, I'm going to accept that there's not. To me, that's probably the biggest, I don't have stats on that, but in my anecdotally, in my experience, that's probably the biggest reason people don't follow Jesus.
You know, this fits in so well with the first chapter of your book, because what we're trying to tell people is we want you to go and get into this system based on loving someone you've never seen, never met, etc., and usually they have no evidence for whatsoever, and then the person saying, you're wanting me to do that for someone I have no reason to believe in, no evidence for, and that would require giving up sleeping with my girlfriend, who have very good evidence for her existence, very good evidence that I love her and she loves me, and heck, I am enjoying the relationship very much. Why should I do that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. If you, and I don't think I even make that connection in the book, so that's an excellent connection. Yeah, if you start out selling the benefits, and then it comes down to whether or not that person's going to break up with their boyfriend or girlfriend, which is what they may need to do to follow Jesus, yeah, how's that going to work if you've just presented it as some sort of great benefit? So, yeah, really good point, Nick.
Yeah, and especially because in our culture, sex is the great deity that we have. Everything pretty much revolves around sexuality. Sex is kind of the great pinnacle, as it were, and how many guys, for instance, would be made fun of because they're still following a Christian walk, and they're how old and they're a virgin still?
Yeah, sex is an interesting topic, and I find, as much as I don't think you should try to sell upfront the benefits that you're going to get, I do think that after you have explained that we need to become Christians because they're true, and you go on to try to explain the Christian worldview more properly, sex is one of those areas where you can really explain the Christian sexual ethic as something that is, in fact, much better than what the world offers. And so I think that a lot of times Christians, you know, we talk about God and sex, and it's all about no, no, no. No, you can't sleep with your girlfriend. No, you can't have premarital sex. No, you can't do all this other stuff. And it's just big negative. It seems like God is a spoil sport and that you're not going to have any fun if you follow Jesus. I actually think we should have a fuller view of what sex is, and that, in fact, within the Christian worldview, it's not that atheists and other skeptics are thinking about sex too much or that they want sex too much. It's that they don't want good enough sex, and they don't want good relationships, and that they're not actually putting enough effort into having really good sexual relationships with their loved ones. And if they followed the Christian sexual ethic, their sex lives would actually be much better. And I had to actually cut some of this out of the book just for time, word count sake, but I do point out that within Christianity, sex is a wonderful, wonderful thing, and it's one of the highest parts of God's creation because it is so close, I think, to interacting with who God is, right? And so by downplaying, I don't think that we should necessarily present the Christian sexual ethic as a negative, as in, well, you have to stop, although you do have to stop doing all that stuff. But it's more that you need to stop playing with poison so I can invite you to the banquet, right? Or stop, you know, making mud pies out in the backyard and come in and have this bountiful feast that I have prepared for you. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, stop doing that stupid stuff with your girlfriend because you're wrecking your life. Come and do this because you will find that it's much, much better. Yeah, it's not, and at this point in the conversation, it's not that you're selling the benefits of Christianity. You're explaining that you don't have the proper view of sex, and it's not that Christianity thinks it's a negative. It's that Christianity thinks it's a positive, and you're not positive enough about it, right? And so that, sex is a really big topic, and I think it's rightfully a big topic in the society. Unfortunately, Satan understands that it's a very big, important topic, and so he has twisted it and made it a topic in a negative sense, whereas as Christians we need to come in and make it a positive and say what are the beauties of having this and its fulfillment. And you and I know, Nick, as happily married people, and mm-hmm. I know a lot of happily married people, those are the people that have the best sex. And mm-hmm. They understand that in fact, their relationship struggles normally in the sexual area only to the point, or to the same degree, perhaps, that they messed things up before they got married and that they're still dealing with a lot of those harder mm-hmm. issues. And so sex is not something that we as Christians need to shy away from. We need to be diving in and wrestling with that topic in a way, a lot of times on a much deeper level than I think we do.
Yeah, I know a shades of Peter Kraft in there. He gave a great talk, for instance, on Is There Sex in Heaven? And I really recommend people listen to that. Before I was married, I think I listened to it 4 or 5 times at least, you know. And I'm also thinking about how Redbook supposedly had a survey once about who has the best sex lives. And Redbook is hardly a bastion of Christianity, and the results came back evangelical Protestant women have the best sex lives.
Huh.
And what Ari and I have noticed whenever we've been watching a movie or a sitcom and such, and we have some that we like, but we notice that when you look at the way the world treats sexuality, that there's no standard whatsoever. And it just leads to so much chaos and there's so much hypocrisy, and we just look and say, you know, they wouldn't be having those problems if they just waited. And that's what Ari and I did. We waited, and I consider the wait worth it.
Yeah, the media it presents this. I mean, the propaganda that we get fed through the media is such a lie. We really need to be on top of exposing it, right? Because in the media, unless it's one of those movies or TV shows, and they do come along that show the emptiness, and sometimes they come along that show the emptiness of that nihilistic worldview where you're just hopping from bed to bed and you're not – I mean, sometimes there are movies out there. But a lot of times, you know, your average sitcom is going to present that as this great thing. Oh, this – you know, they just have the most wonderful relationship. And in reality, that simply is not the case. You just look at the people you know. They're not happy in that situation. Just to scratch a little bit below the surface, and you understand that there's a lot of emptiness, a lot of pain, and the reality of the situation is not what the media presents. And so understanding that, I mean, that is a way we can come in as Christians and really help people to heal, you know, bringing the truth to bear on that situation. That's a good point.
You know, what we've told people before is we know what you see on the movies, we know what you see on the TV, okay? But in reality, things aren't like that. The movies, TV, they often give you the best picture whatsoever, but things are really different in reality. But when you talk about going from bed to bed and such, I also think of how I tell people, so, you know, you can, I tell a repeat approach, you know, you can go out there and wade shallowly in many little pools if you want to. I've got a wife, so I'm just going to dive into the ocean of one woman, okay?
Yeah. You know, and as this relates to skepticism, I think there's even a deeper, I mean, we talked about how immorality in general causes people to rationalize their disbelief in God. And I think that's, we just see that all around. Any sort of, you know, if you fall into, be it adultery, a sexual sin, or other stuff. I mean, maybe you're embezzling money at work, and, well, guess what? Suddenly you're not as strong a church attender as you used to be, right? Or something like this, your relationship with God. And now you're a skeptic. I see the rationalization. Now, when it comes to sexual immorality, I think it goes even deeper and beyond that. And this is one of the reasons I think that that the family and sexual immorality is pushed so greatly. Satan attacks the family so greatly in our culture because the family, as God set it up, is such a great thing. It draws us into the life of God. And actually, I read a great book recently by Mary Eberstadt, who's a sociologist, and the book is called How the West Lost God, if I'm not mistaken. And she talks about the Christianization of the West, okay? And so she says, you might think, I mean, the common story is that first the West lost God, that we abandoned religion, abandoned Christianity, and then we became immoral, and then the family broke down because of sexual immorality, right? So you might think it's lose God, then become sexually immoral, and then break down the family. She says, actually, it's the other way around. If you look at just country to country and church, just on a very sociological level, Christian belief and church attendance and when the family breaks down and when people become all that stuff, it's actually the other way around. First, the family gets attacked through sexual immorality. So sexual immorality is used to attack the family. As the family breaks down, then religious belief breaks down. And to me, that actually makes good sense of the evidence, and it's why, for instance, so many fatherless people have such a hard time believing in God, and people from broken families have a much harder time believing in God. And again, I think that's just a sociological fact. I don't think you need to – there's not much disagreement on that. It's just hard to believe in a loving father when you come from a broken home, especially one without a loving father. Well, I think Satan understands that the family, God set it up to be something that actually draws us into the life of the Trinity. It shows us the life of the Trinity. It shows us love. I mean, the family is set up so that you have to love each other in a certain sense. You can't be selfish living in a big family. I mean, you can try, but it's pretty tough, right? It shows us how to love, and it shows us how people interact, and it really just shows us God. And those that come from a loving family, in some sense, they grow up, whether or not their family's Christian, in some sense, they grow up knowing God, kind of. And that's why Satan goes to such great lengths, I think, to break down the family, to make the family not the traditional notion, to make it sort of this arbitrary thing, and to make sex this arbitrary thing that you can just do, because he knows that people are going to be drawn away from God through that. And so, you know, relating it all to skeptics and immorality, I don't think we can do enough. I mean, we as Christians need to be fighting for the family, not just because it's a good thing to do in the culture war, but because that culture war is a part of the greater spiritual battle that's going on. And a cult that has stronger families is going to be more Christian. It's going to be easier to reach with the gospel. Therefore, even if, just like me as an evangelist, I want the family to stay together. I want there not to be this arbitrary notion of what sex and love and family is, and I want it to be more like reality, more like God, because then I can come in and the gospel has a much more fertile ground to land on. That's another thing. As I studied writing the book, I thought that was really a deep insight into what's behind some of the culture war stuff, and a deep insight into why, for instance, like the story you told, why the guy that's sleeping with his girlfriend is more apt to reject God.
We've got a little over 3.5 minutes left, so we're going to start wrapping things up here. First off, if people want to find out more about you, if they like what they've heard, they want to know more, where do they go?
Yeah, DonJohnsonMinistries.org is my website. We're based out here in Huntington Beach, and so my address and the contact form, if you want to email me directly, it's don@DonJohnsonMinistries.org, but there's also a contact page on the website there. That's probably the best way. You can find all sorts of podcasts and articles and links to some of the other stuff that we do. You know, we're open to... I've got a few people that work with me. A lot of times it's just me, but we're open to come and help out your church, learn how to talk to skeptics, or a lot of training seminars are listed there. So, yeah, I'm easy to get a hold of, and I like to travel. And so, if people are interested in learning more about the ministry or even having me or one of my compatriots out here come and help out at your event, yeah, we're definitely open to doing that.
We've got about 2.5 minutes left. What's the final message you'd like to leave with my audience?
You know, I generally like to close with just a word of encouragement, that it is possible to reach people with the gospel in an intellectual way without being a PhD. Although, I mean, I know people that are listening to this podcast are going to be probably tend towards an affinity for apologetics, and they're probably well-educated. But in general, I mean, you don't have to be, and I think we all can be effective evangelists and effective apologists using conversation, just day-to-day conversation. And I guess I should clarify something that I don't think I clarified enough in the book, is that when I talk about, you know, just talking to skeptics, it's not so much that I expect you to be able to have this great conversation in a 10-minute bus ride or a 10-minute subway ride or whatever, But over the course of a relationship that you've built months and years, directing people towards thinking about the big questions of life is a really effective way to being able to bring in and answer those questions with the gospel. It's a way to present the gospel in a way that's not preachy and, in fact, is an answer to the questions that they'll have. And so, yeah, I just encourage you. You can do it. We can all do it in our different ways. You can adapt this model to whatever personality style you have, I think.
Well, I'd like to thank Don Johnson for being my guest on my show. The book, How to Talk to a Skeptic, an Easy-to-Follow Guide for Natural Conversations and Effective Apologetics, available at Amazon, $10 on Kindle, paperback about 12/31. Don, thanks for being on the show. I hope we'll see you again next time. Sometime.
It has been an absolute pleasure, Nick. Thank you very much.
And next week, we'll have Tom Gilson in. We'll talk about Peter Boghossian. For now, I'm Nick Peters with Deeper Waters Podcast, and I'm signing off. See you next Saturday.